The tabernacle, the instructions of the tabernacle, the Mishkan, was mentioned in last week's parsha, Terumah, and now we deal with primarily what the Kohen should wear as he is ready to provide the service for the Jewish people on a national basis, and what should be in front of the Mishkan. So it's a very, very important parsha, Tetzaveh, in terms that it's like, it's the pinnacle. The pinnacle is they left Egypt, they crossed the sea of Reed, and they were going on, and they're safe, and then they get the Ten Commandments, and the entire Torah, until where we are. Moshe is the leader, the great leader. As a matter of fact, he was so great that at a certain point when they crossed the sea, he was called Melech, he was called the king, and then he was called the master of all prophets, because he was the one who helped them with the Ten Commandments. And it couldn't have been more awe-inspiring. And now we're setting down to national life, and the tabernacle is being built. And now there's one more instruction that needs to be given. And that's the instruction on some of the accoutrements and necessary items surrounding the tabernacle. Now let's see how this begins. Page 339, sentence, the first sentence, which is sentence number 20. Ve'ata tetzave et b'nei Yisrael. And you shall command the children of Israel, ve'yikhu elecha, and they shall take unto themselves, unto you, shemen zayit zach katit lama'or lahalot ner tamid. They should take pure olive oil, which is beaten, and it shall be for a light in order to provide an eternal light. And that is called a ner tamid, an eternal light. Now let me share a few very, very interesting things about this sentence, but I would like to do it in a manner to have your participation. What's very unusual about the word V'ata tetzaveh et b'nei Yisrael? Who's talking to whom? God is talking to Moses. How does it take place in every other place in the Torah when God talks to Moses? V'daber Hashem el Moshe lemor. God speaks to Moses. And definitely, his name is always mentioned. So now, at the very, very pinnacle, at the height, at the completion of his entire task, the beginning of the parsha starts, V'ata tetzaveh et b'nei Yisrael. Furthermore, if you look three sentences down, when the next instruction is being given, it says, V'ata hakrev elecha et Aaron. You shall bring Aaron, your brother, near unto you, and you shall make him into a Kohen. How should that have been said? Either, like you said before, Vaydaber Hashem Moshe Lemar, or if it doesn't say that, how should it be said? Why is God talking like this? Ve'ata tetzaveh, you shall command. Ve'ata hakrev, and you shall bring near. It's like, what's not being mentioned? Moses. It's like, you work hard, you finally do all the hard work, and now you're only being addressed by the word
you.
So the rabbis were concerned about this, and the rabbis made a note that in the entire Torah, this is the only parsha in the entire Torah, with obviously a few exceptions in Deuteronomy, but Deuteronomy, it's understood that his name is not mentioned at times, but the only parsha since Moses is born that the entire parsha Tetzaveh, his name is not mentioned. And it's a very, very unusual thing. So there are a few interesting interpretations that I would like to share with you on why Moses' name is not mentioned in this week's parsha. In next week's parsha, when God and Moses are having a discussion and about the sin of the eagle, the golden calf, Moses says a very unusual statement to God. And he says the statement as follows. Mecheni na misifrecha asher kotavta. If things are not going well between you and the Jewish people, and you want to eliminate, and you want to start all over, Moses says, "Mecheni no misifrecha asher ketavta, erase me from your book." In other words, I don't want you to destroy the Jewish people and start a new people with me. Moses says, "Mecheni no misifrecha asher ketavta, erase me from your book." So basically, one of the interpretations is you have to be very, very careful what you say, because sometimes people will listen to you. Don't worry, most of the time they won't. But sometimes they will. So Moses says, erase me from your entire book. Which book does he refer to? The entire Torah. So God has other plans for the Jewish people. He does forgive them. Things of that nature, and Moses is Moses, but nevertheless, God says to Moses, you had the audacity to say to me, erase me from this holy book, you will be eliminated from Parsha Tetzaveh, and I will only call you by the word you. That's interpretation number one. Then there's another interpretation, which is pointed out by the Vilna Gaon. And the Vilna Gaon was like, he saw certain things that no one else has ever seen. He was like, not a genius, but a genius of a genius. And he saw certain things that no one has ever seen. So he pointed out, this parsha is always read in the beginning of Adar. This is the month of Adar. When did Moses die? Adar, the 7th of Adar. When was the 7th of Adar? This week. Because next week is Purim, and Purim is always on the 15th. So on the 7th of Adar, Moshe was ne'elam. He like disappeared, and no one knows where he is buried. So the Vilna Gaon points out, the Torah was created in such a way that when Moses dies, his name does not appear in the parsha that we read. It's like an unbelievable thing to think that the Torah that was written like this when Moses was still alive should have planned that the week that he dies, his name does not appear. That's yes.
Yes, and I'm just wondering if God possibly distances himself from Moses, because we know that Moses doesn't get to go to the promised land. Is this part of that process?
Yes, you're hitting on the third interpretation, but a little bit different than I had planned. So, but that's the basic point. In next week's parsha, why do the Jewish people worship the golden calf? The basic reason. What's the reason they worship the golden calf?
Fear and doubt.
What? They lost faith in what? In Moses. Because he told them he was going to come back around 40 days. They miscalculated by a number of hours, daytime, nighttime. And he's not down, and they built a golden calf. So in this week's parsha, and obviously we don't know what happened next week until next week, God is preparing the Jewish people that eventually your greatness will be great not only while Moses is alive, but when Moses is not here anymore. So in the entire parsha of Tetzaveh, I'm not going to call him by name in order to let you know that eventually you'll be a great people even without Moses. And then next week when the incident occurs, what God was preparing them for, that if your leader doesn't come back by a certain day, you're still a people. But it wasn't adequate for the Jewish people, and they didn't learn the lesson of Tetzaveh. That even when your leader is not mentioned by name, you still are a significant people. So that leads a little bit into what you were saying. Yes, Roy.
I don't understand. The first interpretation he said is a result of what he says in next week's parsha.
Right.
Then why did he do it the week before?
Because
he knew this is the same.
No. There is an expression which I mentioned a few weeks ago, which is very complicated, Ein Mukdam Uma'ucha Batorah, which means that although the Torah was written a certain way, chronologically, it didn't necessarily take place that way. So we could have something in a later chapter that really took place earlier. That's the principle. So therefore, what he says in next week's parsha, which may have occurred earlier, Mecheni no misifrecha, erase me, took place. God says, okay, you did that, you asked me to erase you, I'm now going to erase you.
But God was speaking to Moses.
Yes, he was speaking to Moses, but he didn't mention him by name.
Well, I look at it that he feels so comfortable with him that they're buddies.
My dear Frida, I still call you Frida, yeah. But I feel comfortable with you.
I know you don't have to say Frida each time you speak
That's
to me.
That's true, but for a whole parsha, I would. At least once.
At least at the beginning,
right. So basically, what the Torah is pointing out is that don't rely exclusively on the charisma of your leader. The purpose of the charismatic leader is to shine the charisma onto you, that each one of you can be that leader in your own way. And that is the reason why Moses' name is not mentioned. As a matter of fact, that is also the reason Moses' name is not mentioned on Passover Seder, except for once, parenthetically, because they were quoting a sentence, so they had to mention Moses' name. But basically, the main person in the whole Haggadah, his name is not mentioned. And it's not that we should have, like most people interpret, that we should have faith that God took us out. Obviously God took us out. But that's not the main thing. The main reason why in this week's Parsha and in the Haggadah Moses is not mentioned is specifically to know that you, the Jewish people, you, each individual family, can achieve great, great heights even without Moses. It's a very important lesson.
It's internalized, Moshe.
Moshe has to be internalized.
Is it also possible that since this deals with the priesthood, that there should be no confusion between the prophet and the priest? I mean, the two should never be mixed.
Moses the leader and the prophet.
Moses the prophet and Aaron the priest.
Right.
That the two must stand separate in historical context.
Right, and throughout history they've always been different people, not one. Yes.
And also the worship of idols. That if Moses becomes too important,
right,
he takes the focus off of God.
And that's why, out of all the people that are buried in the world, the only person that we do not know where he is buried is Moses, because of that reason. Now we'll understand, if you have this idea that the purpose of this parsha is to internalize the Moses, now you'll understand how this parsha begins. The Mishkan is all set up. Now what do we need? Says the Torah, you need to have light. I'll read the next sentence. Ba'ohel Moed, in the tent of meeting, outside the curtain, which is on the Ten Commandments, you should have light from evening until morning. It should be an eternal light. So the light that we have here, which is the Ner Tamid, and the light you have in every synagogue in front of the Aron HaKodesh, comes from this sentence right here. Nowadays we have it that it burns 24 hours, but in the days of old, in the Mikdash, the Kohen was to make sure that it would burn in the nighttime, from night until morning, like a 12-hour period, a 10-hour period, during time of darkness. Once again, what is the reason for that? It's because once Moses is not around anymore, you have to be the people who will provide the light. There will always be people who will emphasize the darkness of the world. And it's not that they are wrong. There is darkness in the world. Nighttime does come. The sun does set. There is illness. There is death. There is pain and there is suffering. But somehow, says the Torah, before you get to the Torah, you have to approach it with light. And that is why the eternal light is always right above the Torah. Because you can look at the Torah and see everything in there in a way of darkness. Like there's an expression that goes, even the devil can quote scripture. That's correct. But not if you have the light that shines on it first. Now, there's something special about this light that I would like to share with you. The first part of this light is it has to be an olive. You have to take olive oil. Now, who knows anything about olives? Does anyone here, you know something about olives? How come you know something about olives?
Because I have olives, so I take them off, I install them.
Okay.
I
so tell me, how do olives taste at the very beginning? Bitter. How do they taste afterwards?
Delicious.
Thank you very much. I didn't even plant you in the audience. But the light, the eternal light, has to come from olive oil. Because you will experience light, and there will be many people that will experience the bitter part and say, this is the only thing that is. It's bitter. Says the Torah, if you have light in front of the Torah, you will realize that from that darkness, specifically from that pain and that suffering, will be a transformative experience, and that's what you need to actually do. And that's why you have to use olive oil. Yes.
What was the difference between the candlestick light?
The menorah.
Menorah.
No, the menorah is in the tent.
It's where the Holy of Holies.
Right.
Next to it.
Next to it. And not in the Holy of Holies. In the Holy of Holies, the only thing that there is the Ten Commandments.
Correct.
But the menorah is in the tent of meeting. This is outside.
Oh, okay. This is at the door.
At the door. Right. I was thinking about that also, because what's the difference? What Lillian said is a good question, is that, you know, when you first read this, you think, well, what about, is this the menorah being mentioned? No, it's not the menorah. The menorah is inside. What this is talking about is outside. It's like, before we go home, we have a mezuzah on our door. Hopefully, the mezuzah on our door with the paragraph of Shema makes our entrance into the home different. I've talked about this a lot. The first word of the Shema is Shema, is to listen. The tendency of most people when they go home is to talk. So when you go home, can you listen? And can other members of the family listen? And so on and so forth. And the same thing applies to Torah. It depends your paradigm, your gestalt, your Weltanschauung, how you will see something. You can always focus on the negative, but if you have the Ner Tamid, which is made from olive oil, you will know that there is darkness, but the purpose of you and the purpose of the Torah is to transform that darkness into light. Elise?
There's a certain concept about the, I don't know if the word's impermanence of time. Talk about Moses dying, he's erased. Also, it seems to me that in the separation between prophet and priest, you have that the how to, like the very specific how to do something,
right,
and the what for,
right,
meaning like here's how you be a leader amongst people, and here Jewish people collectively, here's how, what for you should be that, a light among nations.
Right. As a matter of fact, one of the things which is mentioned in the Mefarshim, one of the purposes of the Jewish people is to be an Or Lagoyim, a light unto the nations. It's a sentence from Yeshayahu, Prophet Isaiah, and you can only be a light unto the nations if first you approach the Torah with light. In other words, there's a big conflict within everyone. The conflict is, should I be a universal person and deal with everyone on universal themes, or should I put a lot of emphasis on particular? There's a big conflict in philosophy about that. Says the Torah, before you go to a universal approach, you first have to have awe of the Torah. You first have to be who you are. And from the sense who you are, the light will shine onto the nations.
So it's like a how-to for a what for.
How, exactly. Now, there's another reason. Yes, Joel?
I was wondering, how do you get away from the commandment to burn oil today? Is it because this only applies to the temple?
And yes, only in the time of the temple.
Right.
I mean, for Hanukkah, if you have a nice menorah, you do burn oil. But this is only in the temple. Now, there's another reason why we use olive. And for this reason, you have to, one is what you mentioned, and thank you very much. And the second reason, you have to go back historically. When was an olive first mentioned in the Torah?
Noah.
Exactly. So if you turn for a moment to the book of Genesis, chapter 8, on page 30, you remember what Noah did in order to know whether the water had subsided? Page 30, sentence 11. Vatovo elav hayona le'et erev, and the yona, the dove, came unto him towards evening. Vehine ale zayit taraf b'fiha, and a freshly plucked olive leaf was in the dove's mouth. So what does that tell us? There's no destruction. That you will eventually, there is destruction, but an olive is the first sign that you take this, you take the suffering, you take the destructive, and you turn it into something constructive. So the first time an olive is mentioned in the Torah is when the bird brings it to Yonah to tell us that there is light, there is life, and the world will go on. The world is not going to be destroyed. So those are two reasons why the olive is mentioned. Number one, it tastes bitter initially, but after it's processed, it tastes sweet. And the second reason is the way it was mentioned first in the time of Noah, that the bird brought it back to Noah to tell us that there was light. Yes, Bob?
Excuse me. Rabbi Tao, whom I sometimes quote, is a beautiful example. That is that the Jewish people are often thought to be represented by olive and the olive oil, and that the olive oil could be used for pleasure, such as the Greeks would, because it's just paradise, whereas the Jewish people would like the world in which everyone benefits. So if you use it for pleasure, you yourself benefit only, but no one else benefiting. But if it's used in an appropriate way,
that's very nice. Nice interpretation that you can use olive for pleasure of oneself, or in addition to that, for the entire world. Yes.
How about the saying, "I come to thee with an olive branch"? Is that Jewish or is that national olive branch makeup?
Right. Where does that come from? That saying, Ken. Where does it come from? I come to you with an olive branch.
Yes.
I guess it comes from the book of Noah. I never thought of that, but I think you're right.
Who is God's representative message, I guess.
Right.
Peace.
Right. So, now let's look at that first sentence again on page 339. The first word is the Yikhu, which means they shall bring unto you. The Bnei Yisrael, the Jews, shall bring unto you this type of oil. So let's take a look at that word, v'yikhu, they shall bring. So the rabbis have a very interesting interpretation on that. That when you do a mitzvah, the process of doing the mitzvah is equally as important as the end result. So the rabbis go out of their way to say that you shouldn't get the olives in an inappropriate way. You should buy them with your own money, and it should be yours. You shouldn't steal it. You should pay for it. It shouldn't be stolen. A lot of people think, well, as long as I have the olive oil and I have the eternal light, that's what the process is equally as important. So one of the things the Torah points out over and over again is that the goal of life is the journey itself. Not getting there, but going there. It's called the art of becoming. Yes?
It also sounds like the relationship is important. They're giving, he's taking, it's like a team process.
Right. It's the relationship between Moses and the people. That it shouldn't only be that Moses is doing it, but the people need to do it to bring it unto him. It's good. Because sometimes a leader tends to do it all, but he needs the community to do it and to bring it unto him. And the second word, elecha, which is unto you, God doesn't need the light. When we do mitzvos, and this sentence is very, very clear in the book of Deuteronomy, it says, L'tov lach kol hayamim. The mitzvos are beneficial for us. God doesn't need the light. So a lot of people think when they do mitzvos, they do it for God. It's not true. God has commanded the mitzvot, so we do it for ourselves. We need the light. People are walking in darkness. And when we put light up in front of the Torah and in front of the Ohel Moed, right by the curtain, then we are reminded of the goodness and the vitality and the excitement of life. So each word is like interpreted in a very special way. Now take a look at sentence 21, Ba'ohel Moed. The word Ohel Moed is a very, very famous word, and everyone knows about it, but because a word becomes so popular, you hardly pay attention to what it really means. So what does the word Ohel mean? Tent. And Moed? Time. So Ohel Moed is called in English the tent of meeting, but that's not really what it means. In contemporary philosophical discussions for the last 100 years, people have been dealing with two concepts, amongst others, space and time. And a lot of people, Jewish intellectual people, say secular philosophy is so exciting, I wish these thoughts would be in the Torah. It's in the Torah and even more so. From the beginning of Parsha Terumah, where God commands us to create a tabernacle, until the middle of the book of Leviticus, Parsha Emor, deals all with the concept of space. And the space is as follows, that wherever you go should be a holy place. But because the multitudes of people need a reminder, that's why we have a shul. And that's why we have a synagogue. And that's why we have a Beit HaMidrash. But ultimately, wherever you go, that space needs to be made holy. V'asuli mikdash, you shall make for me a mikdash, a tabernacle, a sanctuary. V'shochanti b'tocham, and I shall dwell amongst you, amongst them, the people. God doesn't dwell in a synagogue. He dwells in people. And the second expression, the word moed, really means the word time. That's why all the holidays are called moedim, the times. So God is saying, in reference to space and in reference to time, it's up to you to make all your space and all your time significant and holy. For the vast majority of the Jewish people, I'm going to have Shabbat and Yontif and Rosh Chodesh and Passover, Sukkot, Shavuot, and they will be special times for the people. But for the people who have esoteric knowledge, they know that the purpose of all the holidays is to sanctify all time and all space. And therefore, there's a very popular book out right now, which is called Wherever You Go, There You Are. That's what the Torah is saying. Wherever you go, whatever time, There you are. That's the important thing. That's like a summary of the word Ohel Moed. The tent is important, but you, wherever you go, you are that tent. And the time of Shabbat is important, but every time is important. And it's up to you to make the space and the time into a special sanctuary and sanctified time. Yes, Elise.
I hope I'm not getting ahead, but read beyond that, without the veil, which is before the testimony, and you think the veil may be symbolically, you have a little insight, but you're blurred, but you're not clear. So it's the process of gaining increased clarity or psychic understanding. That with clarity, then you can speak, but it's not until throughout the time, it's the process of becoming clear, of lifting the veil.
Right. That's very good. What Elise is saying is, look where this is. It's michutz la parochet, outside the veil. And, for example, in Eastern philosophies, they talk about many people have veils of endarkenment. And in order to get more enlightenment, you have to remove one of the veils. And this is what the Torah is saying. That this is where the light's going to be, outside the parochet. Because it's up to you whether you want to keep that parochet on or you want to remove that parochet. And all of life is removing that parochet and getting it more and more focused on what you, who you really are. Someone once gave me the example, some people who like cameras and they focus the camera. So you look at a picture, you look at it initially, it's a lot of blurry and different distractions. And the process of focusing is really the process of becoming more and more clear on who you are. And for that, you always need to have special light. There was a saying by, I think, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, just like when you go to a museum, you have special lighting above pictures, you should give the same benefit of doubt to people as well. So imagine if there would be a Ner Tamid. Whenever you encounter someone, can you see a Ner Tamid above their head? And if you can, then you would possibly look at them in a different light. Yes?
Along those same lines, what we read last week with the poles and the ark, it's the same wherever you are, wherever you are. Wherever you go, there you are. That's the concept of sharing Sinai with you physically.
Right. That the first aspect of the sanctuary was a portable. The key aspect of the Jewish people is the fact that we are portable. You know, nowadays, whenever there's a famous author, someone will collect some of the writings and will say, the portable Tolstoy. And you buy that book because that's the main writings of Tolstoy, or the portable Freud, the portable Jung, or whatever. And basically, we had this concept by Yehi ben Zohar Ha'aron. This is the portable Torah. It goes wherever you go. In diaspora, in Eretz Yisrael, at home, in shul, wherever you are. Yes, Dr. Phil.
Young rabbi, someone has asked why it was necessary to build an ark since Hashem was the Shekhinah out everywhere.
Yes, but because of that sentence, Va'asuli Mikdash, you shall make for me a sanctuary, it does not say B'shochati B'tocho, that I shall dwell in it. As a matter of fact, God is everywhere. Isaiah says it very nicely. Hashamayim kisiva aretz adam rachlai. The heavens are my throne and the land is my footstool. What type of house are you going to build to me? Isaiah says that. But the point of building a home is for the multitudes of people to feel something a little special. For example, for those who have been to Israel and have been by the Kotel, no matter how we feel, as once we arrive at the airport, we feel something. Some people have accustomed to kiss the land. Then you go, and the ride to Jerusalem is like you're going uphill. Va'alisa el hamakom, you shall go. And finally, you get there, and then something is magnetic and pulls you even further. And it pulls you to the Kotel. And then you want to go a step further and you want to write a little kvittel in the Kotel. Always a little further. But the Shekhinah dwells in each one of us. Yes?
But the other piece is that you know, no man is an island. I mean, part of this is so that community would be together. The synagogue becomes a place for people to actually gather.
Right.
And it's a reminder that we need community.
Yes, we do need community. And it's like Tolstoy has an expression in an essay he writes about, he has an interesting essay called A Confession. It's a fascinating essay. And he talks about the milliards of people, M-I-L-L-I-A-R-D-S. That's his expression, the milliards of people, the millions of people. So for those people, it's very, very important to have a community, very important. But then there are also separate individuals who can strive a little bit even beyond that, that wherever you are is a holy time and a holy place. Now, what do we do? Because we do not have a temple right now. There are two things which we do. One which you know, and the other which I'm going to say right now. The one which you know is we put a Ner Tamid on top of the ark. The other aspect which the rabbis say is when ladies light candles Friday night in their home, they are putting the Ner Tamid in their home. It's a very, very powerful expression, that. And the expression goes, V'tzivu lahadlik ner b'chol Shabbat lichvot Shabbat. Because ultimately, your home is a miniature Beit HaMikdash. And when you light candles, and it's specifically the woman who lights candles, she creates the light over the whole home. The ambience, the atmosphere, is always created not only aesthetically, but also spiritually and psychologically by the ability of the woman to light those candles. The reason I say that is because from time to time some women have shared with me that the atmosphere in their home is sometimes enveloped in darkness. And it may be, but they need to take some personal responsibility in creating that light in a major, major way. No matter what else has been on your mind, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, comes Friday night at around 5:30, you can create that special Shabbat, which will carry over for the entire week, if you light those candles in a certain way. Yes?
She reminds me of when Sarah died, and the light
went out. Right, the light went out in her tent. When Sarah died, the light went out in the tent, and it was only rekindled when? I'm sorry? When Yitzchak and Rivka got married, because they went back into that tent. So when there is what's known as shalom bayis, harmony and peacefulness at home, and then those lightings can really take place.
There's no options whether you do it Friday night or Saturday morning?
Well, let's go back to the olives. Would you want to throw the olives up, or do you want to process it the way they should be processed?
No, this question, because my poor mama used to lit candles, but I never remember it when it was dark. So I was wondering.
Well, maybe your house was always full of light and you didn't sense the darkness.
Sundown, no. You don't do it at night.
Or sundown.
Do it just as sundown is then before it's absolutely dark.
So now let's go back to my original theme. This is the only parsha in the Torah where Moses is not mentioned. And this is the only parsha in the Torah that coincides with the 7th of Adar, the day that Moses dies. And we all know that Moses does not take the Jewish people into Israel. So most people would feel, without Moshe, who is called Melech, a king, without Moshe, who is called Adon Hanavim, the master of all prophets, without Moshe, who knew God, Panim El Panim, face to face, what am I? What is the Jewish people? Can we go on? And the same thing applies to an important figure in your family, a patriarch, a matriarch, a very stabilizing force, a person in your family, and the person is not here anymore. Can we go on? Says the Torah, in front of your home, in your home, and in your shul, and in front of the Beis HaMikdash, you have to light a ner tamid, an eternal light from olives. You have to take the bitterness of the olive, and the bitterness and the darkness of what you experience, and transform it into light. And that can be done. It can be done at home, in shul, in the temple, individually and collectively. And that's the reason we're told about the eternal light here. Because when Moses dies, you mentioned about Sarah dying and the light went out. To some extent, when Moses dies, that light goes out. And therefore, v'yikhu elecha, it is incumbent upon all of us to take and create that eternal light. And once you have that, then no matter what happens in the outside, you're able to proceed into the promised land. Yes.
Isn't that pretty much the point that was made by Ezra and Nehemiah when the temple was destroyed and the people were Babylonian captivity and the people felt it was all over and they took this that concept, and said we can still survive because this is not, we are not that sanctuary, we have the word.
Exactly, not only Ezra and Nehemiah, but also at the destruction of the temple, they asked for one thing, Tain li Yavne v'hachamecha, give me Yavne so I can build the Torah Academy, so the Torah can be portable. Creating that light is a way to go on into life. Exactly. Very well said. In other words, what Lillian has said historically, we've done exactly what the Torah has said in different ways. In other words, during Ezra and Nehemiah, they did certain things. During the destruction of the Second Temple, we went to Yavne, and so on and so forth. Historically, we've always gone on with light in our hands, and we learned that from here. Very good, Lillian. Frida?
That must be why we take the light when a person dies. You immediately, when you go home, you put on the light for that person.
Also, I didn't think of that, but at a house of a mourning, you have what's known as ner neshama, the light of the person's soul, because to some extent, that person's life goes on in you, in the members of the family, that light goes on as well. It's a good analogy. So Lillian mentioned historically, and Frida mentioned also in a sense of mourning in a personal home. Very good. Ken?
This year we've talked about the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Hara. Light, unfortunately, has two aspects to it, fire. Being fire as it is, as we know light. Clearly there is the other aspect of fire, which can burn if not used properly.
What Ken is saying is an interesting thing. It's both obvious but needs to be stated. Light comes from fire, and fire could be very, very destructive. But you have to know how to use that destructiveness and use those olives in the best light possible. Good.
Just take it a step further because it reminds me of what's going on today amongst this very same light that's supposed to illuminate the Torah. For some people, it's the words that it lights up are truly wrong, are truly abysmal, interpreted. So,
right.
Burn with those same words.
Right.
Takes out of context.
Right. Yes,
please. You can see it anyway now, but like the olive leaf is the symbol that the world is not fully destroyed.
Right.
The rainbow was a covenant that he wouldn't destroy the world again. Now maybe God is instructing the Jews that the oil that they're coming forever is shall be the symbol of a Jewish person individually to be better for the collective and for the Jewish people collectively to be better in order to prevent destruction of the world.
Of the world, right.
To repair the world.
Right. One leads to the next. And then the last point I want to make is once you have this, once you have the light will help you fight your Yetzer Hara, your evil inclination. And therefore, what is the next step in the parsha once you fight that? You wear the Kohen, and the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, he wears special clothes, the begadim. Why? Where am I thinking now? When did Bikadim, when did clothes first come into existence? In the Garden of Eden afterwards. So just like the clothes was introduced to help fight the Yetzer Hara, now the clothes of the Kohen Gadol, once there is light, will help him fight that Yetzer Hara as well. Ken, you want to conclude with...